This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello there, and welcome to a brand new, well, sort of brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. Right now, I'm not actually here. Well, I am here, but I'm on holiday. So I'm not doing a podcast because it's the interlull. Like, if I was at home, I would do a podcast because we could chat about stuff, but I'm not, and I'm not going to do a podcast while I'm on holiday. Apart from the podcast I think I might have done, although I can't be sure I have. Because that would mean I can look into the future. My plan at this moment in time while recording this bit is to do an Arsecast Extra with James while I'm on holiday. But, you know, maybe it won't happen. Maybe the internet won't work. Maybe we can't find a time to connect. Maybe there's something that stops us doing it. I can't say. So perhaps there has been a podcast, perhaps there hasn't. But right now, there is. This is an actual podcast that you're listening to. It's one that was made available to Arseblog members on Patreon a good few weeks ago now, and we got to say thank you to all of our friends who support us on Patreon and help us to do everything that we do on the site when it comes to making podcasts, writing blogs, articles, coverage of the women's team, coverage of the youth team. Your support, if you are an Arseblog member on Patreon, really helps us do all of that stuff and will help us to do more in the future. So thank you very, very much indeed again. We really do appreciate it. This interview is with an Arsenal legend. And the word legend is bandied around, thrown out there willy-nilly these days. But this well and truly is an Arsenal legend. He came to the club from Dublin, Ireland in the 1970s, established himself as one of the club's best and greatest ever players. He went to Italy, he played for Juventus, he played for Inter Milan, Sampdoria, amongst others. He did come back to England, played with West Ham for a while, and then became the head of the youth academy at Arsenal. He's performed ambassadorial roles for the club, but it's what he did on the pitch that makes him an Arsenal legend. And of course, I am talking about Liam Brady. He was my first Arsenal hero, although I never got to see him play live in the flesh. I was just a kid living up in Yorkshire at that stage, and London felt very, very far away. But, you know, when you're Irish and you're living in England and Arsenal have all these Irish players, it's easy to make a connection. And I've been wanting to chat with Liam for ages, and he has promised to do it with me, and we actually got around to doing it this summer. So it did take place, I think the end of June, perhaps. Sometime around there, anyway. I think the World Cup was on and Arsenal were still in the midst of their summer. So you have to listen to the conversation in that context, because we talk a bit about the hopes for the new season under the new manager and all that kind of stuff. But it is as well a career retrospective from Dublin to London to Italy, back to London and everything else in between. I do hope you enjoy it. I know some of you have heard it before, but maybe it's just worth listening to again. This is me and Liam Brady. Okay, it's my great pleasure now to introduce a real Arsenal legend to the podcast. Something we've been threatening to do for a little while, but finally we got around to doing it. Liam Brady, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So I think we might do a little bit of a career retrospective, if we like, because I we've got lots of fans who will have seen you play and who grew up with you at Arsenal, but we've got lots of new fans who know of you as an Arsenal legend and somebody who was a great player for the club. So I'm interested in how it happened for you as a young lad from Dublin joining Arsenal. You were, what, just 15 when you
went? I was 15,
up?
But I first went when I was 13,
right,
on trial.
So
and that would have been, what, 1969. And at that time in Dublin, all the best young players usually found themselves going to Manchester United.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of a story, but it's a story worth telling, that there's a guy in Dublin called Bill Darby, who is the Arsenal scout, has been the Arsenal scout for many, many years. But in that time, he decided to write to Gordon Clark, who was the chief scout at Arsenal, and say, look, you've got nobody in Dublin, and Manchester United are taking all the best young players. Why don't you appoint me, and I'll steer them in your direction? So I think Gordon was impressed by the letter and sent one of his safer scouts, let's say, one of his good scouts from North Wales, over to Dublin. So the guy came from Holyhead on the boat, came over, and his name was Malwyn Roberts. And Malwyn told me the story that he said to Bill Darby, like, take me to the best match where the best players are playing at under 13 level or something like
right.
that.
Right. So who were you playing for?
I played for St. Kevin's in Whitehall.
Right.
Ellenfield Park we were playing. And that's how it came to happen. Bill took him to the match, and Malwyn said, oh, I like the little inside forward. You know, where does he live? Went around my house, said to my mother, you know, who introduced himself and said, you know, we'd like to ask your son to come over on trial. And, well, that's how it started. And I jumped at the chance. I was waiting for this for, you know, dreaming of it for... I didn't think it might be Arsenal necessarily, but I was hoping it was going to happen, that I could... Because my brothers had gone to England. Like, I had brothers 19, 20 years older than me. I was a bit of a mistake coming along at the very tail end of a family of seven.
Right.
And so they had been in... they had played in England and were still playing in England at some level in those days. And... I couldn't wait to get the chance to go. And then Arsenal came. I went over that summer of 69 in I think it was August 69 they used to have their trials, and I did well, and they asked me to come back, and then they asked me to sign. And I, when I left school at 15, I went to London to live and to for good.
Right.
We say for good, but I had an apprentice contract
which
could last 2 or 3 years, and I had to prove myself in that time.
Did you have any reservations about leaving home or leaving Dublin or going to live somewhere else? Or was it like, okay, my brothers have done this, you can see the
path?
Well,
my brothers went as older people, as adults, you know. They went when they were 19 and 20. Whereas going at 15 was, well, it was a bit daunting, but no, I had no hesitation in going. But when I got there, you know, there were times that were hard, and, you know, particularly around Christmas and things like that. You come home for Christmas, they give you a week or so off, but you have to go back, and it's kind of, it was tough. But I got through it and, you know, began to make progress in the second and third year of my apprenticeship. Well, they signed me after 2 years. At 17, they signed me professional.
It was a smaller club back then, so I take it was easier to get to know what Arsenal was about. Was that something that you were... that was part of the apprenticeship, in a like, it was to understand the club and what it meant and who you were playing against, the rivalries, you know, the North London thing. Was that something that was part of it, or did you just naturally pick that up?
No, that was very part of it, you know. That was indoctrinated in you, you know, that you had to beat Spurs at every possible chance. And you know, when I joined, we just won the double in 71, and we had, you know, stars like Charlie George and Frank McClintock and John Radford and Ray Kennedy. They were, you know, big players in the English game at the time. So I was joining a club right at the very top, just won the double. The double had only been won 10 years prior to that by Spurs. And hardly ever, you know, there's been a good few doubles since then, and thankfully we've done them. But no, then it was a special thing to do, and it was a special club. We knew what the standards were. The standards were very high. You have to be, You would have to be a good player to break into the Arsenal first team then.
Yeah. But I mean, having done the double in 71, it was another 8 years before Arsenal won a trophy. It took, you know, there wasn't exactly a case where they built on that success in 71. So did that make it easier for you to get into the team in a way?
Oh, yes, yeah, without any doubt. It that team broke up, in my opinion, far too quickly. They lost Don Howe after the double in 71, and I think that was a defining moment for that team.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Bertie Mee was obviously a very good manager, a very good organizer, very strict, and had standards and had raised the standards at the club. But Don Howe was the brain behind the way the team played and the tactics that were used, and you know, he was probably advising Bertie Mee on all football matters.
Yeah,
and he left, so I think that was a big blow for the squad of players that were there at the time.
Yeah,
and over the course of 2 years, it just kind of fell away, and we went from being you know, double winners to probably non competitors. And by the time we get to 1974, you know,
yeah,
I think we got to the semi final of the cup in 73, and that was a big thing then. I think we lost to Sunderland away at Hillsborough, and I was at that match, and after that the team really broke up, and
right,
then all the kids began to get a chance. Bertie Mee in the following year, I think, decided to give the kids a chance, and I got my debut and started to play from there. Then Bertie got sacked and Terry Neill came in.
Yeah.
And we did okay in the first year, but it wasn't a happy camp, and
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the level of coaching and ambition for the club wasn't great, and it was only when he brought Don Howe back in.
Right,
Don was up at Leeds as a number two to Jimmy Armfield. But he brought Don back in, and things changed very quickly, and we began to become a team again.
Is he an underappreciated figure at Arsenal, Don Howe, in terms of what he did and the impact he had on?
Yeah, well, looking back at Don's career, you know, he was a brilliant number two,
yeah,
and not a great number one. And I think, you know, football does have people like that, where they're better off working in the background and not in the headlights.
Brian Kidd,
yeah,
is a
he
good
could
example
be
of that.
Described as a good number two. Yeah, you know, this guy that's working with Southgate now, is doing a very, very good job up behind the scenes and quietly, while England go about their business of trying to get to the World Cup final. And I think Don really gave us targets, gave us aims to not only as a team but also as individuals to improve our game. And everybody, to a man, bought into it. And then Terry Neill bought some good players. You know, we bought Pat Jennings, which was very important. He, you know, a great goalkeeper, who Spurs thought were probably coming to the end.
Yeah.
And Willie Young was a good partner for David O'Leary at the centre of the defence. Then a year later, we bought Brian Talbot. A couple of years later, we bought Brian Talbot, who was a really tremendous midfield player at the time.
Yeah.
You know? So Alan Sunderland was also a good buy from Wolverhampton.
Yeah.
And then, so you had all those new players. Terry, prior to Don coming, had bought Malcolm McDonald, you know.
Mm.
And Malcolm was the star, but he wasn't really a team player.
Right.
And, you know, Malcolm had problems with his knee after a year or so, and he kind of fell away, and Stapledon and Sunderland became the two lads up front who,
yeah,
you know, very, very good playing together.
There was a great Irish contingent at Arsenal at that time, because I grew up in England, and I think people ask me, why are you an Arsenal fan? And the only reason I can think of is because I was living in England with Irish parents, really interested in football. But when you looked across the Arsenal team, there was Liam Brady, there was David O'Leary, Frank Stapleton, John Devine, there was the guys from Northern Ireland, Pat Jennings, Sammy Nelson, Pat Rice. You know, at that point in my life, I had no conception of the difference, really, between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It was just Ireland. You know, these were Irish guys. Did that make it easier for you in any way? Or was it do you look back on that as something that was special? Because I think there is a generation of Arsenal fans of my age who probably have that connection with the club because of you guys.
Yeah, well, no, I think I was a bit of the trailblazer, you know, coming in from Dublin because of this letter that went to Gordon Clark, the chief scout. Like, that was probably, at the time, you know, one of the things that helped Arsenal in the late 70s, that letter, because we got Stapleton and O'Leary, who turned out to be really top-class players. And like, David's probably the best players that's ever played for Arsenal. And you know, I think he's got the record number of games for Arsenal, which is quite incredible. But he came on the back of that letter, and then you know, Bill Darby then became the Arsenal scout, and that's why all these young players from Dublin started playing for Arsenal. And Pat Rice was always there. Pat grew up around the corner from Arsenal. He was Irish, but from his parents. I think he was born in Belfast, and then they came to London when Pat was at a very early age. Sammy, on the other hand, had been scouted by our representative in Belfast and brought. So Pat and Sammy were there, and then of course Terry went and bought Pat Jennings, which was the best signing he ever made, I reckon.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
He was...
Who would you put in front of him? You're a bit young to, Andrew, but I don't think Terry made a better signing than Pat Jennings.
Yeah, he was amazing. I remember him, particularly in the World Cup in 1982, making some amazing saves in that game against Brazil.
Yeah, and he went on for so long. Like, when you think he came to Arsenal about 77, I think it was, and Spurs thought he'd seen his
what
best
was that
days.
Like? What was that
and he
like?
He had another 10. He got a testimonial out of Arsenal.
What was it like, though, when he came from Tottenham, given the rivalry and given, you know, what you said about it being indoctrinated into you? Was there any...
He must have felt... He never said it. Pat's a very quiet, unassuming guy. Yeah. He's a lovely, lovely man. And he never said anything, but he must have felt uncomfortable at the outset. He must have done. But I think he was upset at the way he had been treated by Spurs. So there was also a determination there. I'll show them.
Right. You know?
And I think when we beat them 5-0 over at White Hart Lane, Pat was in our goal and wasn't in the other goal. He was a happy man that day in a strange kind of way. He's still very much 1.5 feet in the Spurs camp, and the other half comes over to us now and again.
And that 5-0 was when you scored that goal.
And Alan Sunderland scored 3. It was a lucky game for all of us because it was on Match of the Day. And what you have to understand, Andrew, and what your younger listeners will not understand, is those games were not always on the television.
Yeah, no, I remember.
You were lucky if you were on the television. Yeah. As a player, you'd probably, if you were on Match of the Day on a Saturday night, might make you go home early and watch it. Whereas if you weren't on Match of the Day, you'd probably stay out and have a few drinks with the lads.
Video recorders weren't even really a thing.
No,
then
they
either,
were just so. They were just coming along. Yeah,
so no on demand, no watching back. You had to be there sitting in front of your TV. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah.
Is that your favourite goal?
I'd have to say it is. I scored a good few good goals for Arsenal, but I'd have to say that is my favourite one. We played Leeds one night and we beat them 7-0 in the League Cup, and I scored 2 goals, but 2 penalties. But the football we played that night was absolutely outstanding, you know.
And that's a game that's lost to time.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, people say to me, what do you, you know, what would you want from the modern game today? Mm. It's the pitches they play on, you know. They play pristine pitches all season long.
Yeah.
But that night we played Leeds. It was just the start of the season. It was the first game of the League Cup. It was probably about September time, and Highbury was immaculate, and we just moved the ball about so much. We were so confident that we beat Leeds 7-0 against the Leeds, you know, good Leeds side. They were first division side then. So, no, the my career then in the 70s and with all the Irish lads in the team and the signings that Terry made, we became a very, very strong team in the Cups.
Yeah.
But we didn't have a lot of depth to the squad. And we could beat anyone on a day, but unfortunately, we never really challenged for the league. And that began to annoy me because we had the nucleus of a really good team, but the club on Terry didn't have the ambition to go and you know get the players that were out there to make us a much stronger outfit when it came to challenging for the league,
for the title. Yeah, I mean the 79 FA Cup. People who listen to the podcast regularly will hear me tell the story. It's the first game I remember, first Arsenal game I properly remember. First game I remember is the 78 World Cup final, being absolutely gutted that that Holland lost. But the 79 FA Cup final, I believe deep down that it taught me a lot about football because it was so enjoyable. We were 2-0 up. There was only a couple of minutes left. It looked like we were going to win. And then all of a sudden, they score two goals. And you're thinking, what the fuck is going on here? This is not the way it's supposed to be. And then all of a sudden, you know, you take the ball, you give it to Graham Ricks. Graham Ricks crosses it. Alan Sunderland scores. And you're immediately happy again. I think there are important lessons in that, in the sense that, okay, you think it's going one way, all of a sudden it's going a different way, and then just when you think it's going to go the wrong way, it can go the right way again. Yeah. You know, there's a learning experience for that. That and 1980 FA Cup final was another learning experience.
Well, you know, we're speaking now during the World Cup,
yeah.
And we've seen from this year's World Cup those things that can happen. Look at Japan against Belgium,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
They're winning 2-0 with, what, 5-10 minutes to go. And all of a sudden the game changes and then it goes into the last minute and they get a corner kick instead of boxing clever and keeping the ball and going into another half an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They get caught on a breakaway. Like how heartbreaking was that?
Yeah.
And that is football. You know, you mustn't count your chickens ever.
No. But was 79 obviously a great experience?
Yes, it was, because then the FA Cup was huge.
Yeah.
You know, the FA Cup then, and people probably will find it hard, younger listeners will find it hard, it was every bit as important as the league, you know. Okay, the league proved to you that who was the best team over 42 league games. But the Cup was where all the glamour was and all the, you know, the razzmatazz was.
The Saturday of the Cup final.
Yeah,
it was like,
and if you were as a manager won the Cup, your job was safer. You know, you would go down in the history of the club, you know, in those times. Now it's, you know, what we've seen, how many Cups we've won, it's not really mattered. You know, we're going on to the modern day now. And Arsene Wenger has won, I don't know how many cups he's
seven.
Won, but he's the guy who's won the most FA Cups.
Mm.
And, you know, in the end, winning the cup didn't really matter. It didn't really,
figure.
It wasn't enough, you know.
So, I mean, 1980 was a disappointing year in terms of what the club might have achieved and what you might have achieved as a player, with two finals, the FA Cup final and the Cup Winners' Cup final. Against Valencia.
Yeah, that was we were a really good team, and you know, to get to another two finals again after 79, I think demonstrated that this would be our third FA Cup final on the trot. And not only that, was we got into a European final, into the Cup Winners' Cup final, and we had to beat Juventus in the semi final. So it showed, you know, what a good team we were on our day. But again, I'll go back. We didn't really add to the squad, and you know, my contract was coming to the end in 1980, And because we hadn't shown the ambition that I thought we should have shown, and got better players in to challenge the likes of Liverpool for the league, I'd kind of made up my mind, and I wanted to move on. And Arsenal supporters will say, "Well, that's wrong." Some Arsenal supporters would say, "Well, that's wrong." But if you stand in my shoes at the time, you know, Kevin Keegan had gone to Germany and done really well.
Yeah.
Tony Woodcock had gone to Germany, done really well. There was a whole kind of new way of football opening up to players, and I started to think, well, you know, I might be better off going abroad, and that's what I decided to do.
Was it always abroad that was in your mind? I mean, look,
yeah,
nowadays...
Look, I spoke to Manchester United, I spoke to Liverpool at the time, you know, yeah. And I didn't want to go anywhere but abroad, you
right.
know.
How does that work back then? Because I think if we think about transfers now, we know that players have agents and managers and advisors, and there are these structures in place, whereas players moving from Division One or from England to clubs abroad was very rare back then.
Well, it started, as I say, it started and agents began to appear on the scene, and Dennis Roach was one of the trailblazers in the agency game at that time, and he was my agent, he was Glenn Hoddle's agent, I think he was Tony Woodcock's agent, he wanted to know what I wanted to do, and I told him I would love to go abroad, I would love to go play football in Germany, you know.
Mm.
And Bayern Munich, I met Uli Hoeneß, I've since met Uli a few times when I was working as an ambassador for Arsenal when we played Bayern Munich,
yeah.
and myself and Uli met on the quiet in London many years ago before my contract came to an end, and I thought I was maybe Dennis Roach, I thought maybe I was going to go to Bayern Munich,
right?
But when
did the Juventus interest come?
In and around the turn of the year 79-80, the Italians opened up their borders to foreign players again.
Yeah.
They'd stopped it because there was an opinion by the hierarchy in Italian football that the foreigners were stopping Italy having a good team. A bit like there's an argument. Has been an argument in England that the foreign players haven't helped the development of English players because they're not playing often enough. So there was that debate was going on in Italy, and they stopped foreign players from coming in for over 10 years, and then they opened it up again.
Mm.
And I think when I played against Juventus, I was on their radar, and then it eventually led to me signing for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very difficult club to turn down, isn't it? Because of the reputation, because of the quality of them as well. And
if I was going to leave Arsenal, I wanted to go to a really top club. You know, I met Martin Edwards at Manchester United. I met Brian Clough rang me up and said,
what was that conversation like?
That was funny, that was, yeah, you know. Do you know who this is, young man? I said, I think it is. Mr. Clough, isn't it? And he said, yes, you're right, young man. And he told me, if you come to Nottingham Forest, I'll pay you a fortune or something like that.
Right.
And I said, no, I really want to have a go at going abroad, you know.
Mm. Fair enough. Did you go to Italy with the desire to experience not just football but life in Italy as fully as you can? Because sometimes players can get, or they can live inside of a bubble in a way at a foreign club, whereas there's a whole big world out there culturally and everything else.
Yeah, well, I had enough, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
I wanted to go abroad in the first place. So, in fact, that was the last few months at Arsenal. I thought it might be Germany, and I was learning German, you know. I began to try and learn some of the language. And then, you know, when I went to Italy, I had the attitude was, look, you know, you enjoy this, you'll enjoy it if you can learn the language. And I got stuck into the language. I got myself a teacher and went on from there. It was a big move for me, but I'd already moved from Dublin to London as a kid, and you know, I had that experience under my belt. So going to Italy, although it was a bit, it wasn't scary, it was exciting rather than scary, you know. So and sometimes you're going into the unknown is better than going into what you know. You know, if I hadn't known what Italy was like and how critical they could be and how football is life and death, you know,
sure,
I might have had second thoughts, but I didn't really know that at the time. So
How quickly did you come to terms with that, or how quickly did it become apparent to you that that was a big difference between the way football operates in Italy and England?
Probably after a couple of months, you know. I remember playing, they don't play the league immediately over in Italy, or at least they didn't then. The first competitive games of the season are in the cup, and they put like a group of four teams or maybe three teams in the cup, and the best club is seeded. Like you'll play maybe second division clubs or something like that. It's an easy start into the season, and the smaller clubs get a big gate by getting one of the top clubs come and play at their ground. So it's a good way to start the season. So I started fine, and you know, things were going well, and then the league kicked off, you know.
Yeah.
And we were playing at Cagliari in Sardinia in September, and it was absolutely boiling. And, you know, I don't do heat. Being Irish, white skin, I don't do the heat very well. And I had a very quiet game, and I got on the bus. I wasn't happy. We drew 1-1. We got on the bus. I wasn't happy. I was sitting there saying, you know, so I was quite tough for myself if I didn't think I played well enough.
Sure.
And I heard one of our directors say, how did Inter get on today? You know, I began, by then I'm there 3 months, so I'm beginning to understand what they're saying, you know. And he said, someone said to him they won 4-1 because Inter were the champions, you know, that's the team we had to you know, finish above of.
Right.
And he said, Did Prohaska, who was their foreigner, I was Juventus's foreigner, Prohaska was an Austrian midfield player, and the guy said, yeah, he scored, they won 4-1, he scored. And the Juventus director said, oh, we bought the wrong foreigner. And I was sitting on the bus, and I went, a bit early for that, isn't it?
Wow, yeah, that's from one of your own directors.
Yeah.
What's your reaction when you hear that? Is it a case of, well, I'm going to have to double down and prove you wrong, or is it?
I never forgot it. When he was coming to kiss me at the end of the season after we won the league, I think I gave him the cold shoulder. Stay away from me.
obviously, you enjoyed the experience in Italy. You were there 7 years. I mean, even leaving Juventus, it was after two seasons. People still talk about that penalty. You knew Michel Platini was coming to replace you as the foreigner. Maybe you could have two foreigners at that point. I can't quite remember.
They opened it was one foreigner for my first 2 years, and then it became two foreigners, and they signed Boniek from Poland. And I think when they signed Boniek from Poland, you don't know what's going on in Italy, but Fiat were the owners of Italy, Gianni Agnelli and Fiat and things like that. And I think Fiat did a deal with a Polish car company, and Boniek was part of the deal, you know. So Boniek came. I think Agnelli put a factory into Poland to get Boniek, you know, that type of thing. You know, all these things were going on. So anyway, I thought I was going to be playing with Boniek, but Agnelli took a shine to Michel Platini, who he'd seen on his travels, and obviously Platini was up there. But I had no idea. We'd won the league, and we were winning it again the following season. So it was like I was dumbstruck, you know, when I was told that
you were on the way.
Yeah, yeah. crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And that's Italy, you know, that's Italy. And England now has become a bit like that.
Yeah,
you know?
That's okay, football now, isn't it?
We don't have restrictions on how many foreign players we can have. But
not yet.
They come and go so quickly, don't they? You know, players come and go so quickly. You think you have a player forever, like someone like Sanchez at Arsenal, you think, wow, we want him, you know, what a player. Yeah, we don't want to ever lose him. After 3 years, he's gone, you know.
I think that's
England's become a bit like the Italy I played in.
I remember, I mean, that was something that always struck me about Italy, is the fact that the big players went between the big clubs far more than they ever did in England. So you could play for Juventus, you could play for Inter, you could play for Roma, and that was unthinkable, really, when it came to the top players in England. You didn't play for Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal, whereas times have changed.
Yeah, well, you know, that's... And also the stuff in the newspapers, how critical newspapers can be in England, that was never the case, you know. Now they attack players left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And it's become managers are sacked after a few games. That didn't happen in England, but it always happened in Italy, you know.
So when your time in Italy was coming to a close, I think I can remember scanning the newspapers all the time to see, you know, if there was this remote possibility of Liam Brady coming back to Arsenal. Was that ever a thing?
Well, it was foremost in my mind, but no, I found out quite soon that when I was coming back, I had a... In those days, you had... There were agents about, but there were also journalists about, right, Andrew. So you would have a journalist who would have a direct line to a manager. You know, he could pick up the phone. And I had a very good friend of mine who worked in the News of the World called Reg Drury, who was old school. He was a good pal of mine. Mm. You know, he gave me advice on things. He knew a lot of people running football in England at the time.
Right.
Reg had a direct line to George Graham. And so I said, Reg, find out, will you? And George said, thanks, but no thanks. I think he didn't want to step backwards.
Right.
He didn't want to, you know,
overshadow
what he was doing. And he did right. You know, he was building a team there with a lot of young players, and he wanted to make his own signings. And what he'd done at the club at the time is he got rid of a lot of the older players.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember, but Charlie was there. Charlie Nicholas was left. Graham Ricks was there. They all gradually left. Kenny Sampson.
Yeah.
And he replaced them with his own signings, the likes of Winterburn and these lads came in. And,
yeah.
So, you know, George was his own man, and he did right. But I ended up going back to London, to West Ham.
Yeah.
I got, speaking through Reg, I got contact with John Lyle. And
it's amazing, isn't it? The deal back to a first division club is not brokered by a journalist, but, you know, in some ways brought about.
Oh, absolutely.
That way,
Well, that's the way it used to be. Yeah, it used to be. There was... a distaste for agents then, because they were new on the scene, and clubs were saying, we don't have anything to do with these guys. But journalists were, you know, had their ear, and you know, they could find out things and also give the club information about things.
Different times.
Yeah,
different
absolutely
times,
different
for sure.
Times, yeah.
What about your international career with Ireland? I mean, you obviously, I can't remember how many caps you have.
I had 72 caps.
72.
Yeah. Well,
you didn't get to play at Euro.
No, I came so close. You know, I came so close in '88. I played in all the eight qualifying games, and we finished top of a group with Belgium, Scotland, and Bulgaria. You know, so we did really, really well. It was Jack Charlton's first competitive competition, the qualifiers for the Euro 88. And what about when he came, I would have been 29, 30 maybe, you know, getting on.
Yeah.
But I was still playing. I was still playing in Italy. Then I came back to West Ham. And we played all these qualifiers, and it ended up with... we played Bulgaria at Lansdowne Road, in our last match, but Bulgaria had another game. If we beat Bulgaria, we'd go top of the group, but they had a game against Scotland, and if they only drew that game,
yeah,
they would top the group. So when we played Bulgaria, we felt we had a little chance, but we owed them for what went on in Sofia.
Right.
It was a nasty match in Sofia, and we felt we were robbed over there. So we gave it to them here at Lansdowne. We beat them 2-0. But in the last 5 minutes, I got myself sent off stupidly for retaliation. And when I come off the pitch, I thought, well, that's it now. You know, that's my international career over. I'm 31 now. It was 1987. I'm 31. It's over. And went in the dressing room and... You know, we were all happy that we were top of the group, but nobody gave, you know, Scotland any chance of going to Sofia and winning, you know. Well, a month later or 3 weeks later, that's exactly what happened, and I couldn't believe it. Now, I waited. I started in 74. Now it's 88 now or 87 now, so...
Because Ireland did come close, didn't they, under Owen Hand?
Yeah, and a couple of times we got done. Once on goal difference with
Belgium.
France and Belgium in the group in 82, I think that was. Mm. Yeah. So we'd gone close a few times. We had a good team, really good team. You know, we had Mark Lawrenson from Liverpool. We had Ronnie Whelan from Liverpool. You know, we had Frank. Frank by then was at Manchester United. We had Aldridge up front.
Yeah.
Paul McGrath, you know, great players. We had a great... Ray Houghton had come in the team. A really strong team. Anyway, Scotland go and beat Bulgaria, and I can't believe it. I've waited all this time, and now I'm not going to be able to play in it because I got four-match ban.
What did you do to get four matches?
Well, I struck the guy in the face, you know. You know, he'd been at me all day, and I just lost it in the last few minutes. Very stupid.
Out of character a bit as well.
Yeah. So, long story, but we go to UEFA disciplinary committee to appeal it. And it was a funny day. You know, I had two guys from the FAI who were nervous, as you know, and they didn't make a very good presentation, to be quite honest. And I thought, no chance here. But I think they felt sorry for me, and they gave me a 2-game less.
Right.
So I went from 4-2, which meant I could still be part of the squad and maybe play a game or two if we went further in the competition.
Sure.
But then a week or so later, I did my cruciate ligament playing for West Ham
at
Derby County, and that was the end of it. So
right.
I did come back into the squads when we qualified for 1990, but by then I think Jack had kind of was phasing me out, and people had come in that midfield area, like Andy Townsend and Ronnie Whelan and things like that.
He was looking for something different.
Yeah. So I didn't get to go to 1990, and that was the end of my career. I retired at West Ham, and I retired after I didn't make the squad for 1990.
Right. So you went into management with Brighton and Celtic.
Well, Celtic first.
Yeah.
I wish I had been the other way around.
Right.
To be quite honest, you know, Celtic was a very big job at the time, and it was a job that was probably like a bit like Steven Gerrard going into Rangers now. Mm. You know, he's up against a formidable force. When I went into Celtic, it was the other way around. Rangers were the formidable force.
Right.
And they had it all going for them, the strength, the money, and so forth. Celtic were in a bit of disarray as regards shareholders and fans and all sorts of things. So I wish I had gone with the experience of management under my belt, and I went in at the deep end, and you know, I didn't succeed. So
did it have an impact on what you thought about what you were going to do with your future in terms of, did you enjoy management?
I did, yeah. I did enjoy it, yeah. There's certain aspects of, you know, our pressure, there's a lot of pressure, but I did enjoy it. Well, it didn't put me off. After Celtic, I knew, well, I wasn't going to, get a big position unless I really proved myself. Mm. And I went down to Brighton, and I think I did show at Brighton that I could manage. And I took over a team that had no money and nothing going for it. And we were in relegation situation, and we got up the table, and then I got some loan players in that I'd go out and watch. We got Dickoff down there. It was an absolute sensation.
Paul Dickoff.
Yeah, I plagued George Graham to let me have him. And it did Paul the world of good coming down there, because, I think he only played 6 games for us, where he scored 5 goals. And, we got Brighton going again.
Yeah.
And the crowds went from nothing to up to double figures, 10,000-11,000 people coming. But then the people running Brighton at the time were real messy people, and they were only in it to sell the club and get money and things like that.
Right.
So after that finished, I thought, I'm done with management. I want to think about doing something else.
Okay, so the something else was to become head of youth development at Arsenal, and that's a substantial job, particularly at a time when football was beginning to change as well, and the knowledge about young players. I mean, you lived through a time where basically nobody knew who the reserves at any club were, to a point where everybody knows everything about the under 16s onwards. You know, this is the world we live in now when it comes to young players. So was it interesting to watch that kind of transition and the impact it might have had on young players? Did it have an impact on players, do you think? They had this sort of measure of fame in a way that wasn't there in the past.
Yeah, I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's healthy for players to have fame on reputation only, or some guy on social media has seen them play and said he's the next best thing, and then all of a sudden the kid's reading about it. You know that's going on, and I don't think it does the young players any favors.
Is it not just another challenge that they have to overcome or to deal with? Because this is the way the world is now. I mean,
you're not going to change it. It's there, and it's here to stay, and it has to be dealt with, not only by the player, but by the club as well.
Yeah.
You know, the club have got to manage that situation and make sure that the player is not carried away with it all. But then, you have to give that player, if he's a real prospect, you have to give him a lot of money to sign a professional contract.
Yeah.
And he'll have an agent, and the agent will be saying, I can get you, if Arsenal don't give you what you want, or if the club don't give you what you want, I can get you to go there, there, there.
Yeah.
And it's unhealthy. It doesn't fit with a player working at his game to become better and to become as good as he can be.
So the emphasis is maybe on how much you can earn as early as you can earn
it. Trappings rather than, the ambition that you should have.
Do obviously agents and managers and parents and the people around players must have an impact on that as well, that they can push a young kid in a direction that isn't necessarily the best for their football, but it's best for their financial prospects in the short term, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. And that is happening. It doesn't only just happen at one club. It happens all over, across the board.
Yeah.
And this is what clubs and everybody in football, the administrators, have to deal with, There's a situation in England now where they've created academies. We're going back a few years now, but they've created academies and different standards of academies. You can have Category 1, Category 2, Category 3. And to be Category 1, you had to have certain standards, and you would be audited to see if you had those standards.
Right.
And if you got Category 1 status, that was supposed to be, rubber stamped that you were, excellent at development of young players. But what was happening then, one category one club would start poaching another category one club. So it was chaos out there, you know. And I think in the last couple of years, they've stopped the clubs with who money's no problem, poaching players from the clubs. Because it's unsettling for a kid. What do you want to have a kid, and his parents for that matter, is his feet on the ground, the next two or three years of his development planned, and he knows what's coming, and he works at his game, and he has nothing outside distracting him. But the world they live in now is not like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like that. They're getting a lot of money early on, so they'll stay at clubs. There's even the lure of going abroad before you've done anything. You know, there's been a lot of players. Like one player's left Man City to go to Dortmund. Jadon Sanchez.
We've had Chris Willock.
Chris Willock go to Benfica.
Yeah.
Marcus McGuinn go to Barcelona. So. All that's going on, you know, and I don't think it's right. You should have your 3 or 4 years planned from 15 to 18 or 15 to 19, and you're going to work at your game, you know where you're going to be. And then at 19, if you're not, you know, pushing on to the first team squad, then make a decision then, but not, you know, not at 16.
Is there not something to be said for that experience though, from a, not just from a footballing point of view, but on a human level, to go abroad, to experience a new culture, a new type of football,
I did it at 24 when I went to 24.
Well, when you left Dublin to go to London in a way as well, you know, it gives you a different kind, perspective on the world, right?
I wouldn't argue with that, but then you're going. Then when I was coming from Dublin, I was coming from amateur football to professional football.
Sure, yeah.
These are leaving top clubs in England to go over there, and the only reason they're going over there is money. You know,
well, prospects as well, though. I mean, Jadon Sancho is playing on a regular basis, which he probably wouldn't have done if he'd stayed with Manchester City.
Well, he would have done. I think Manchester City would have loaned him somewhere, and he would have been playing. Yeah,
but he's not doing his reputation or his career any harm, I don't think. You know, with that kind of a move.
No, I wouldn't argue with you there, Andrew. I wouldn't argue with you there. Perhaps in his case, it's a good plan. We were talking about how to keep a kid's feet on the ground and how to keep his parents' feet on the ground, and guide them in the direction of being a footballer, not only for the next 2 years, but being a footballer for the next 12 years, for the next 14 years, is to have a career plan.
Yeah.
You know, and this is what's got to happen. And the kids have got to buy into it. Like, I think if you look at the England team that are doing well at the World Cup now, you've got lads who've had it come up the hard way. You've got lads who've you know, Kane, for instance, had to go on loan to several clubs. He didn't really break into the Tottenham first team until he was 21, 22. Yeah. So he worked at his game to get where he is. And the likes of Maguire is another one. Stone started at Barnsley. I think the trappings that are coming their way is actually not doing them any good at all.
So how do we then, as Arsenal fans and Arsenal people, how do we tally that and your concerns about that with players like Cesc Fabregas and Hector Bellerin, who have been brought to Arsenal in much the same way that Marcus McGuinn and Chris Willock have gone to Benfica and Barcelona respectively? So I mean, there is something to be said for players who are willing to take a risk and do something a bit different. If you can spot the talent and you're willing to give them a chance.
No, that's absolutely right. You're correct. But what I found with the foreign players coming the other direction, let's say we were getting them from Spain, in the case of Fabregas and Bellerin, and the foreign players coming to London, Seb Larsson when he came to Arsenal, the foreign players coming to London or coming to England have a different mindset. It's a career move, and it's not like for a quick fix.
Right.
They're coming because the club has been sold to them. You can get into the first team earlier, Arsenal, which was the case, and to be fair to Wenger, he always gave young players a chance if he thought they were good enough.
Yeah.
And the kids knew that when they were coming, so they had that kind of mindset. I'm not too sure it's the other way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you must have seen lots of young players come and go down the years, players who you felt had a really great chance of making it, but because of attitude, perhaps, or because of bad advice, because of being distracted by some of the trappings that you talk about, have never achieved what you felt or Arsenal as a club felt they could achieve.
Yeah, there's been quite a few. And it's not only at Arsenal, but it's everywhere, because I would talk to my contemporaries at other clubs, and
of course,
they would have high hopes for a lot of players, and it never really materialised because, because the players didn't have that ambition to be professional and disciplined, and they got carried away with the money they were earning, the car they were driving, and never trained on as such. They were, if you put a horse racing analogy, they were a good 2-year-old, but they never trained on.
Sure. Is that disappointing?
It's frustrating. It really is. But it's frustrating for them more than anything else, because
at some point they have a realization, right?
Well,
you would think.
You know, I get phone calls from some of them saying, you know, can you help me? You know, I need a club. You know, can you get me a trial somewhere? You know, and these are kids that were highly rated when they were 16, 17.
Yeah. That's difficult, though, right?
Yeah, well, that's what can happen. And, you know, I used to say to boys when they signed professional contracts at Arsenal, I used to say, make sure this is your worst professional contract that you're ever going to sign. They're only going to get better from here. And how are you going to make them better? You've got to work at your game. You've got to improve. You've got to listen to what the coaches are telling you. Don't think you know it all. You've got to work on the weak aspects of your game and things like that. And make sure this is the worst contract that you're going to get. But so often, Andrew, it turns out to be the best contract that they get, and they never match that or come near it again.
I suppose the difficulty is that you're dealing with young men at an age where that mindset is... We've all been through that period where you think you know better than your parents or whoever it might be. There's a natural tendency for a bit of a rebellion, isn't there? And all that kind of stuff that you're dealing with. It's just a natural part of being a young man.
Yeah, and also intellect as well. You know, if you have a good brain, you'll realize that what you're being told is correct, and you'll work at it, you know. Whereas I agree with you, you're at 16 and 17, you feel you know it all, and they don't know nothing. And you might have an agent as well telling you that they don't know nothing, i.e. the clubs don't know nothing, and you don't have to worry about them, because if they don't like you, I'll get you another club.
Sure.
You know, and the kids buy into what the agent's telling them. And then, you know, a few years later, people like me are getting phone calls to see if you can get clubs for them.
You know. What do you make of the changes at youth level at Arsenal this season, with Per Mertesacker going in, Freddie Ljungberg coming in as the under-23 coach? They've added a number of backroom staff as well. That has been a significant change, because a couple of years ago we brought in Andreas Jonker. I'm not sure that worked out quite as well as he would have liked, or whoever made the appointment would have liked. It's a change of direction, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, Mertesacker knows the club inside out now. He knows the culture of the club. He knows the standards of the club. So I think to have a next player go in there is a good appointment. I recommended that when I decided to leave, that there should be an ex-Arsenal player come in, and he should be trained up rather than, you know, find somebody who wasn't an Arsenal person, who's had experience in football. I thought it was vital that they needed an Arsenal person.
Can I ask you why you feel like, I agree with you, I think it is important, but could you maybe just expand on why you think it's such an important thing for somebody who understands the club to be in there and to have those positions?
Well, he's got to be loyal to the club, first and foremost, and he's got to work in the best interest of the club, first and foremost.
Yeah.
And he's also got to explain the club to the parents and to the young players themselves,
yeah,
and have standards and have discipline and so forth, and because that's what I was brought up with, and I'm sure that's what a person like Lee Dixon, who I recommended for the position, has been brought up with. He knows what the club's DNA is,
yeah,
and I thought it should be an Arsenal person, but it didn't happen, I don't think it worked, you know, for the two or three years. There was a stalling, I think, at the academy. Now, hopefully, Mertesacker can get it back going again.
2 to 3 years is quite a long time, isn't it? If you're talking about a stalling, you're talking about, you know, that length of time without producing anyone.
Well, the players, you know, the players, there's kids coming along who've really got good prospects that have been at the club prior to Anders Jonker coming, you know. So we had them in there at under 12 and under 14 and things like that. And they've got prospects, but what I'd be concerned about now is that we haven't brought any young players from other clubs, might be other English clubs or lesser clubs that have proved to be good enough to break into the Arsenal first team. And I think that's an area where Mertesacker has to look at and make sure it improves.
I just brought in a kid from Sunderland yesterday, Sam Greenwood, a striker who's 16. So who do you view as the prospects at the club right now, the ones who might have a chance of making the breakthrough?
Well, you know, it's very difficult for a kid at 18 and 19 to come in and hold down a place at a club like Arsenal. It's become harder as the years have gone on because the competition in and around you has become that much stronger.
And also the expectation of fans when things maybe aren't going as well as people might like. It's difficult, isn't it, to throw in a young player when the, let's say under the last number of years under Arsene Wenger, and to his credit, he has brought, he did bring players through, but it is more difficult to do that when people are demanding the title, when they're looking for the Premier League.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely, or even to finish in the top four is not easy now, is it? Because there's 6, maybe 7 teams out there that is real competition, so... No, the obvious people are the ones that the Arsenal fans have already seen: Reece Nelson, Eddie Nketiah, maybe young Willock. But they probably need to go out on loan now, and we need to secure their contracts, and they need to go out on loan and need to learn the game at a good level that gives the people at Arsenal a chance to see how they're doing, and bring them back in when the time is ready. That's the way it is. You know, if you look at the England team that's playing at the World Cup now, a lot of those players have been on loan.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way you develop them. It's very, very difficult now for a kid to come in and get into a first team at 18 and stay there.
Sure. You know? What do you think of this change to the Checkatrade trophy rules, which we'll see our young players play against League One and League Two teams?
Well, I think...
Is that positive for... Is it just something that selfishly is good for Arsenal, or is it good for the competition itself in that it gives it a bit more profile? But certainly for the development of young players, all these games are going to be played away from home against men.
I think it's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't compare to sending a kid on loan.
Right.
And let's say sending him to a club like a club in the Championship, maybe Derby County or Wolverhampton Wanderers. I know Wolves have come up now and it's a different club, but you know, lads went out there and you find your feet and you have to show what you what you're good at, and you got to perform regularly. You know, we had a situation going back a few years where we loaned Larson, Muamba and Bentner to Birmingham.
That's right.
And that was the best thing for them. No Checkatrade trophy would have helped them.
Yeah.
What helped them was going to Birmingham, playing in the championship and trying to get promotion.
Yeah.
And that's the way that you develop a young player now, unless he's absolutely special and he comes into the first team and stays there.
Yeah.
Unless he's a Fabregas.
Right, there are not too many of those around, unfortunately.
No.
There really aren't.
No.
Just a couple of quick things very finally. It is a big change this summer at Arsenal. Unai Emery is in as the new head coach. There's a new structure, and Arsene Wenger, after so many years, has gone. How did you think the departure and the announcement of it, and maybe the build-up to it, how did you feel that was handled by the club?
Well, it was going to come, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
when I was going to the Emirates, and I go nearly every home game, there was an awful lot of empty seats, you know, and fans weren't necessarily giving up their season tickets, but they just wanted change, and their way of protesting was a lot of empty seats. So I think the club's realisation was, we have to change, you know. And yeah, I know a lot of people have said it, but maybe Arsenal would have been better going after that Chelsea victory in the cup when we were still in the top four, and I think we were. And
no, I think we finished fifth that season.
But we beat Chelsea in the cup.
There was a high.
Or maybe the Aston Villa one was. Did we finish in the top four?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and beat Aston Villa in the cup, and he might have been. But I think he was offered another contract, and he stayed. And it was difficult because Arsenal had done so much for the club and had brought the club to just another level, and the club built the stadium on the back of his work, they built the training ground on the back of his work, and he'd really taken the club from one level to another level, and it was difficult to see him going, but I suppose if you look back on how he went out in style.
Yeah.
And credit to the club for handling that the way they did. So what we've got now is we've got a new manager with new ideas, and I think we're all looking forward to seeing what he can do with this team. I think he has problems with this team. I think it's going to take him at least a year to get to grips with what's needed.
What problems do you think he has to deal with going into this season?
Well, I think we've got a problem. His biggest problem with it, he's got players who haven't got a winning mentality, who are not winners. When Arsene took over, and we're going back to 1996 now, he had winners in his squad, about six, seven, or eight of them, you know, who'd been winners under George Graham. None of these guys are winners. You take Peter Cech out of the equation. I don't believe any of them are winners, you know, in England. So he's got to do something about that. And I don't know whether they're of the standard that he can do something. I don't expect a league title challenge in any way, shape, or form this season. I'd be happy, very, very happy, if he can get us back into the Champions League. And I think the people who appointed him will be as well.
I think that's realistic. I mean, you said to me probably at the start of last season when we met here briefly, and you said you were worried, you thought we would finish outside the top four, probably sixth, you said. I remember you saying it, we finished sixth. So I mean, it is a realistic expectation, isn't it, for a top four. That's got to be, I won't say the limit of our expectation for this first season, but in a first season, he's got to come in, he's learning a new language, he's getting to know all the players and everything else. So if he can get us back into the top four, that would be a successful first season for him.
That would be a successful season. It'll be ironic, really, because Arsene Wenger has been telling us for the last dozen years that is success, and the media were ridiculing him, and so were a lot of our fans. That's not success for Arsenal.
Yeah.
But the money we spend on transfers And the fact that we can't really compete because our business model is, well, we have a business model, whereas Manchester City and Chelsea don't have any business model. And, yeah, and Manchester United are desperate to get back to the top, so they're going to splash money at it as well. So we're down the pecking order in what we can afford. So, you know, he will have to be a very, very special manager to get a title challenge out of these players. I think he's going to come to terms with this season that's coming. He's going to learn an awful lot about the players that he's got. And if the board or if the people, the powers that be, back him, they'll need to make substantial changes going into the following season.
So how confident are you in the people running the club and making those decisions? I mean, it sounds like you're talking about there needs to be a little bit of a change in the business model in terms of what Arsenal can invest to attract better players, to create a team that can mount a title challenge. I mean, do you have concerns about the ownership structure or the way that the club is operated now? I mean, a lot has changed this summer. Ivan Gazidis is now taking a more hands-on role, it seems, in the running of things, not just from a business point of view, but from a football point of view. Raul Sanyehi is the director of football, ostensibly. Sven Mislintat is the head of recruitment. Is that the structure Arsenal need?
We'll see, won't we? You know, we're going to see what's going to happen. You know, Ivan Gazidis had the problem of Arsene Wenger there, and Arsene wouldn't want any change. Didn't want any change. He wanted to run the club the way it had always been run. Mm. And Ivan now has changed everybody, so he has got the guys you mentioned in place, and we'll see how good they all are, you know, but they're up against it because they're up against some powerful clubs who spend an awful lot of money, and we'll have to see whether Stan Kroenke has the appetite to invest more money into the team. All those things are going to come out now that Arsene Wenger's gone. We're going to see probably in black and white, you know, where we're going as a football club.
All right. Well, we don't have too long to wait for a new season, so we'll keep fingers crossed it goes the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want Emery to succeed. I loved Arsene, and I hope he does very well whatever he does. He was great to me as head of youth development. He always gave young players a chance. Now we'll see what this new guy is going to do for us. And I wish him all the best. I'll be watching and I'll be supporting.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, we'll look forward to it, Liam. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a million.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. That was the one and only Liam Brady. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you're coming to it for the first time, you could have heard it weeks ago by signing up to be an Arsblog member on Patreon. Just €5 a month gets you access to loads of extra content, loads of podcasts and written content. And every subscription helps support what we do here on Arsblog and Arsblog News and the podcasts as well. So if you're at home right now thinking about what you could do with a fiver every month, there's an option for you. I mean, you could go and just buy a sandwich. Personally, I wouldn't hold that against you at all. Sandwiches are amazing. But if you did feel like subscribing, it would be very, very much appreciated too. You can do that by going to patreon.com/arsblog. patreon.com/arsblog. Now, I'm on holidays as we speak, and I've scheduled this to go out so people will have something to listen to on the Friday of the interlull. James and I will have an Arscast Extra for you on Monday, I think. I don't really know yet because we haven't made that arrangement because it's too far in the future, as I was saying at the beginning. But we will have an Arscast Extra for you at some point on Monday or early next week anyway. I'll take some time out of my holiday to make sure that you've got a podcast to listen to early in the week. So for now, I'm going to get back to probably being out in the sunshine, almost certainly drinking a beer, and quite definitely eating ham on Ruffles like they're going out of fashion. So until the next one, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Adios. Please note, there is a very, very funny bit at the end of this podcast. However, due to rights restrictions and your location, this content is unavailable to you. Which is a tremendous shame, because it really is side-splittingly funny. In fact, I don't think there's ever been a funnier bit at the end of an Arscast. Oh my God, you are missing out so, so much. While you sit here frustrated, others are laughing. The mirth is unparalleled. If you have any complaints about this, please bring them up with your government. Your government are the ones to blame, certainly not Arsblog. This end bit will self-destruct in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Your government prevented the detonator going off. Wankers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.